case for argument is United States v. Stadfeld. Mr. Rueckert.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Stephen Rueckert and I represent the appellant, Jacob Stadfeld. In my time, limited time here, I'd like to focus on my suppression issue. And I will admit to the court, I have not found any cases directly on point. The closest I came was that habeas case out of the district court in Michigan. And in that case, the district court of Michigan sent the case back saying that statements made while the defendant was uncounseled, basically, should be suppressed. Now, in saying that I don't have any cases directly on point, there is a case in the Seventh Circuit here, United States versus Cahill. And I think the language of Cahill fits my case, the facts anyway, in my case pretty closely. Cahill said that if a defendant's perception that he has immunity is reasonable, that would make his statements involuntary. I'm suggesting to the court, in this particular case, there is no question that Mr. Stadfeld's perception that he had immunity was reasonable. And this case is a little bit unique in that perspective because you don't have to rely on just the defendant's statement that he believed he had immunity. There was lengthy testimony by his attorneys who admit they didn't have a clue. They believed, based on their conversations with the state prosecutor, that he had global immunity.
But the prosecutor didn't mislead him, right?
I'm not saying that, well, maybe by omission, Judge.
Well,
There were four interviews.
Well, I don't know that the prosecutor would have a duty to advise someone that, you know, we'll give you immunity, but the Department of Justice may go after you.
I think I agree with you.
Since he has a lawyer, right?
I think I agree with you.
Yeah.
However, there were numerous interviews, and
his problem is with his lawyer, right?
Exactly. There's no question about it, and that's my argument. And if you look at some of the Sixth Amendment cases I've cited, Kansas versus Ventress, and even Messiah. Now, I understand that those cases talk about when a defendant is uncounseled. And even in the Frazier case, what happened was his attorney, the defendant's attorney in that case, abandoned him, basically, during interrogations. What I'm suggesting to you in this court is, to this court, is that in this case, what these lawyers did is tantamount to being uncounseled. Because they're sitting in these interviews with the defendant thinking that whatever he says here is going to be immune from prosecution. They didn't realize the fact that, hey, even whatever he says, and forget about this breach argument for a second. Once he started talking, to quote another Wisconsin colloquialism, I think the horse is out of the barn. Because at that point, there was no agreement with the federal government. Everybody agrees with that. The government has argued that. So once he started talking, the federal government could use his statements regardless. His lawyers didn't know that. His lawyers entered into this wink and a nod agreement with the state prosecutor that they never chose to put in writing so we could review it later. It was just some oral agreement that you go in there and talk to him. Now that, to me, is the same as being uncounseled. Especially, how about this? The last interview with Stadfeld, an FBI agent or a DEA agent sat in the interview. Do you think that should have triggered something with his lawyers? But it didn't. They still sat in there thinking they had this complete immunity from any prosecution. And I'm suggesting to the court that under Cahill, that makes Mr. Stadfeld's perception that he had immunity reasonable. And if it is reasonable, I think under Cahill, the statements would be involuntary. And I suggest that if the statements are involuntary, the use of those statements at Mr. Stadfeld's trial would be a violation of his Fifth Amendment right. And you are correct, Judge. I am blaming it on the lawyers. I think he got no counsel in this case. It was completely ineffective. I think the government concedes that. The government doesn't concede the but-for part, prong of Strickland, but...
Of course, the government argues that even if he had an airtight immunity agreement, he violated it by false statements in the interview.
Never had an agreement with the federal government. Never.
No. The point is, even if he had, he violated it, and so it would have been void, right?
Well, hypothetically, yes, if he had an agreement with the federal government. But you can't. I don't know how you can talk about a breach of an agreement you're not party to. Since the federal government was never party to this agreement.
The argument is that if he had been properly advised by his lawyer, he would have insisted that the immunity agreement embrace the federal government. So suppose the federal government had said, fine, okay. But nevertheless, this agreement is conditional on your being truthful, and he's untruthful. So in other words, if there had been no incompetence by the lawyer, and there had been the comprehensive immunity agreement, he still couldn't rely on it because he wasn't truthful, right?
Well, I have to answer that question, yes.
Yeah, right.
Except that those aren't the facts in this case.
It doesn't matter. It just shows that this is that the ineffectiveness of his lawyer was irrelevant because he was going to lie.
Well,
right?
He would have had
the same incentive. Well, not the same incentive, but...
Well, I don't know if you can predict that somebody's going to lie in four different interviews. I can't speak to that. My point is this, that once they sat in there and allowed him to talk at all, the damage was done. I mean, they had a lot of options available. They could have gone in, taken the Fifth, and made the state go get immunity.
But don't you agree his case would have been stronger if he had told the truth?
I must certainly agree. I don't think it precludes a remedy here, however.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Rueckert. Mr. Graber?
Hey, please, the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dan Graber. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Madison office, and I handled the trial in this case. Let me focus in on the suppression issue. The Strickland claim that they're bringing, he focuses a lot of time in the brief and at oral argument on prong one in terms of the attorneys being ineffective. What he's missing is prong two, the prejudice prong, which is what the magistrate judge and Judge Crabb dealt with, the but-for causation. The attorney that he's saying is giving him bad advice and what he believed was a complete immunity deal. What they're forgetting is that it was a conditional. Even under his terms, if he believed he had a complete deal, it was conditional on him telling the truth. He broke that condition. He lied. He breached the agreement. He voided the agreement. He can't prove prejudice. And that's what the court found. That but-for causation was severed by an intervening act of the defendant, by him breaching the agreement. That's why the Strickland claim falls. So their fallback argument now is this Cahill argument, the Cishan and Cahill argument, which is basically what's going on in my head if I've got this this belief that I had immunity, even though there was no misconduct by any government actor, that if I hold it under the reasonable person standard, that therefore I do have immunity. Again, the reason the breach is so important here is because of the conditional immunity agreement. What was in his head, you don't focus in on what the federal government did or didn't do because there wasn't a promise. As he says, there wasn't a promise between the parties. Correct. You're not focusing on what the federal government did. What you're focusing on is what's in his head based on what his lawyer told him. And what he's advancing is, in my head, I thought I had a complete immunity grant. And what counsel's arguing is, so breach doesn't matter because I had a complete immunity grant. What he's forgetting is it was a conditional immunity grant. And by his client knowingly walking over the line and breaching the immunity grant, he can't meet the reasonable person standard because no reasonable person is going to think that they had a complete immunity grant when they knew it was conditioned on telling the truth, and then they lie and they break the condition, then they know they don't have immunity. And that's what the court found in denying the Cahill and the Cishan argument.
Are you suggesting that at no point he couldn't reasonably conclude, Mr. Graber, that he had a complete immunity?
I argued, Your Honor.
Because I want to get a sort of a temporal aspect of this, of when this idea of, well, I also may not be truthful, comes into play.
Correct. I think on the front end, that under the reasonable person standard, when you look at all the facts and circumstances, that the reasonable person would not find that
with
they had a complete...
of a federal officer, that wouldn't add a thumb on the scale to suggest that this thing also might encompass, for a lay defendant, the possibility that the immunity is global?
The immunity grant happened at the first hearing on April 15th.
Mm-hmm.
There were no federal agents, no AUSAs. On July 15th,
yeah.
At the last one...
It's awful hard for me to get my mind around when this reasonable thought should have occurred or not occurred as to when he might have had immunity.
Correct. And that's our argument, is that all the facts and circumstances based on that first meeting shows that the reasonable person wouldn't believe they had a complete immunity grant. It was a state investigation, a state John Doe into a missing persons investigation with small amounts of drugs, no federal connection. There were no federal actors involved in that first meeting. It was an ADA and two local state cops. They never asked for federal immunity. It was never offered.
They couldn't. How could they grant it if it was asked for? You had a defense lawyer with a state prosecutor. State prosecutor authorized to grant it?
I asked them that at the breach hearing because we had an evidentiary hearing on this, Your Honor, where I brought that out. I put the ADI on the stand and said, let's talk. What he said was, had they done that, I would have took a time out. I would have called up the U.S. Attorney's Office and seen if I could get an agreement out of them and then come back to them and do that.
Did they do that with the other witnesses in the John Doe?
In the John Doe, what they did with some of the other witnesses, Your Honor, is different counsel said, I want statutory immunity. They'd put their client in, they would take five, and then the state judge would then immunize. And so some of them went down that path. What this client did with Mr. Statfeld was the more informal path of trying to work out with the, because his counsel wanted to be there and hear the questions and the back and forth, and they went with this more informal immunity with the ADA, which in Dane County they don't reduce to writing. It's all oral. Those are my points, unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Graber. Mr. Recker?
Well, I think what Mr. Graber indicated is more proof of the ineffective assistance of counsel here. I mean, there were so many options available to them other than this informal oral agreement with the state prosecutor. And I completely agree with the notion that when they saw this federal agent in the last interview, shouldn't that at least have kicked off something in their mind? But they had no clue. And they even have testified under oath, I thought this was binding on the federal government. Completely wrong. I thought that he had complete immunity. Completely wrong. But that is what they communicated to their client.
What did they say they based that on?
Their ignorance, Your Honor.
Okay, not objective circumstances.
Pardon?
I mean, we're on the reasonable person standard here.
What
there
did the lawyers?
There were no objective circumstances that would support a reasonable belief that immunity was global.
Other than the fact that he is listening to his lawyers.
Right, but the attorney's subjective belief tells us nothing about the objective circumstances. That's my point. They screwed up.
They screwed up, exactly.
There's no question about that.
But doesn't the client have a right to rely on his lawyer's advice? And doesn't that lead him to a reasonable perception that he has immunity?
When all of the objective circumstances say otherwise.
Well, I don't know.
The state John Doe, state prosecutor, state cops, the federal agent doesn't come in until, like, the third statement, is it?
I understand it, but I quoted a part from a Wisconsin law journal that says, that dictated to defense lawyers in Wisconsin, if you get this sort
I
of situation.
I get that they messed up.
Well,
I think everybody agrees.
Okay,
on
my
that.
Suggestion is that's a Sixth Amendment violation that caused Mr. Stadfeld to involuntarily waive his right to Miranda. And when the use of those statements, when the federal government then chose to use his statements against him in a federal trial, that was a violation of the Fifth Amendment.
Right, and that gets us into the prejudice analysis, which cuts against your client because of the lies.
Well, we go back to the lies again, and again, there was no agreement with the federal government. My position is, once he started talking, and isn't the proof in the pudding here? They used his statements. They used the statements he made to the law enforcement people to prosecute him. So they must have believed some of them. And those were said regardless of any agreement, because they didn't have one with him.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Director.
You're welcome.
Mr. Graver. Next case for argument is...